Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 11, Non-Transparent Actively Managed ETFs, Smart Beta ETFs, and the SEC's Derivatives Proposal. Chris Mincani, Laura Flores, and Jack O'Brien will discuss non-transparent actively managed ETFs and Smart Beta ETFs and the SEC's Derivatives Proposal. Now, on to the podcast.
We've got a lot to cover in this panel, and we're going to dip our toes into the world of registered funds, specifically exchange-traded funds and the use of derivatives by registered investment companies. My name is Chris Mincone. I'm joined by my partners, Laura Flores and Jack O'Brien. I'm going to be covering non-transparent actively managed ETFs. And so what's going on in this world? There's been a lot of developments, but let's start with the basics. What are they? Essentially, it's an actively managed portfolio, and it's registered under the 1940 Act, and it seeks to make its portfolio holdings non-transparent. In other words, they don't disclose their portfolio holdings to the public. And why are they desirable? Well, fund managers have an interest in keeping their portfolio strategies and concepts out of the public view, out of public eye, so that they can maintain confidentiality around their intellectual property, their strategies. In other words, if they were disclosing their strategies or their portfolio holdings, they'd in essence be giving away their secret sauce. So what's the issue? Why aren't there non-transparent actively managed ETFs in the marketplace right now? With one exception that we'll get to later. Under current SEC rules, you cannot have an actively managed ETF that does not disclose its portfolio holdings. One of the primary basis, a fundamental underpinning for the operation of actively managed ETFs is that they disclose their portfolio holdings on a daily basis. And this is to promote or foster the arbitrage mechanism, which is designed to keep the market price close to the fund's net asset value. And we can draw a distinction between actively managed funds and passive funds as well. Passive ETFs don't have to disclose their entire portfolio holdings on a daily basis. They only have to disclose their creation baskets, what the fund puts out for authorized participants, and authorized participants are large financial institutions that are able to transact directly with the fund. Authorized participants deliver creation basket securities and redeem creation basket securities. The exemptive relief that the SEC gives to actively managed funds currently requires full portfolio transparency. Another important distinction while we're on the topic of index versus active is that actively managed funds and passive funds have to list on an exchange, so they exchange traded shares, but index funds can rely on what are known as the generic listing standards, and most index funds fit those standards. And what that means is that they can breeze right through, get listed on an exchange with just a simple notice to the SEC. On the other hand, actively managed funds have to go through a filing process, all actively managed ETFs, and that process can take up to 240 days. And why that's important here for this group in particular is that recently the SEC has been scrutinizing what we call these 19B4 applications for actively managed funds that engage in a heavy use of derivatives. That's kind of a side point, but I think worth noting. Transparent actively managed funds were first authorized or permitted by the SEC back in 2008. At the end of 2015, of the 2,052 ETFs in the marketplace, only 134 of them, representing $28 billion in assets, were actively managed funds. So it kind of gives you a sense that fund managers aren't necessarily gravitating to the fully transparent actively managed ETFs. I think it all goes back to that, you know, giving up the secret sauce idea. So what is the challenge? I kind of mentioned it earlier, the challenge with getting these non-transparent actively managed ETFs through the SEC. Again, it's the notion that Full transparency allows for an effective arbitrage mechanism. It allows the authorized participants and the market makers to transact with the fund, to keep the market price of the fund shares close to the net asset value calculated by the fund on a daily basis, as well as allowing the market makers and authorized participants to effectively hedge their positions, which is an important economic part for the APs and market makers. So earlier I had said that there aren't any non-transparent actively managed ETFs in the marketplace, with one exception. So has the SEC permitted any? Yes, they have, except the type that they've permitted isn't what we would consider a true exchange-traded fund. It's kind of a hybrid. It's a hybrid between an ETF and a mutual fund. And these are known as exchange-traded managed funds. These funds are permitted to maintain the confidentiality of their portfolio holdings. They don't disclose on a daily basis like actively managed ETFs. In fact, they don't disclose anything other than a creation basket, which does not necessarily have to be a pro rata slice of the ETMF's portfolio. And that's an important point, too. For index-based ETFs and transparent, actively managed ETFs, those creation baskets that they put out have to be a pro rata slice of the portfolio. ETMFs aren't required to do that. The unique feature of ETMFs is that they don't necessarily trade at market prices. They trade based on a scheme known as NAV-based trading. And what that means is that as an investor, you put an order in on the exchange, and you're going to get the NAV next computed, just like a mutual fund or any other ETF, but you're going to buy at a determined, at the time you put your order in, discount or premium to that NAV. So you don't know exactly what your purchase price is when you put your order in, but you know that it'll be a certain less a cent or plus 2 cents from NAV. So ETMFs, again, are a hybrid, and the advisor gets to determine the particular securities that are disclosed in the creation basket, which is important. And again, it goes back to the notion that it does not have to be a pro rata slice of the portfolio. So as long as the advisor believes that the securities that are being put into the creation basket are appropriate for the fund's investment program and in light of its policies, the advisor is allowed to put those types of securities into the basket. Another distinction between ETMFs and ETFs is that ETMFs have a much smaller creation unit size. ETMFs transact in creation unit sizes of anywhere from 5,000 to 50,000 fund shares. ETFs, on the other hand, index or active, typically trade anywhere from 50 to 100,000 or even up to 250,000 shares per creation unit. And like mutual funds, another kind of comparison to mutual funds, in the absence of having to disclose their holdings daily, ETMFs are only required to disclose their portfolio holdings, like mutual funds, on a quarterly basis with a 60-day lag. And one other important distinction between ETFs that are currently trading in the marketplace and ETMFs is that ETFs rely on the arbitrage mechanism, that back and forth between market makers and authorized participants with the fund in order to keep the market price close to NAV. Here, there is no arbitrage mechanism. There's no need for an arbitrage mechanism. There's really no need to know the portfolio holdings. The market makers and authorized participants dealing with ETMFs can profit simply by knowing what the cost is to engage in a creation unit transaction and being able to accumulate shares or sell shares that are trading in the secondary market at a lesser cost. So that's an important distinction. Now, has the SEC considered any other types of non-transparent, actively managed ETFs? And the answer to that is yes. They have considered a few different types. None have been permitted to date, but there's at least two worth talking about. There's the blind trust model and the proxy data model. The blind trust model was considered by the SEC and rejected on a variety of grounds in 2014. The blind trust model is essentially using an intermediary, which in this case would be the ETF's custodian, to act between the ETF and the authorized participant. When an AP redeems a creation unit to the fund, the portfolio securities that are redeemed in kind to the AP would not be delivered to the AP. Rather, they'd be delivered to the ETF's custodian in the blind trust. And in this way, the portfolio securities or the holdings of the ETF, which, again, the basket is a pro rata slice of the ETF's overall portfolio, wouldn't be known to the authorized participant. The blind trust model, in addition to relying on that structure, the blind trust model to conceal portfolio holdings, would have relied very heavily on what's known as the intraday indicative value. All ETFs, putting aside ETMFs, are required to disclose throughout the day on a 15-second interval basis an intraday indicative value of the portfolio. This structure would have relied very heavily on indicative value, and the SEC criticized that approach on a number of grounds. They thought that 15 seconds was way too long, given how quickly the market moves. So an IIV is effectively stale. The SEC believed that market makers and authorized participants had many other sources of data at their disposal when they're dealing with actively managed ETFs to come up with their own indicative values. The SEC thought that indicative values didn't necessarily reflect the true value of the portfolio at any given point. For example, an ETF might hold illiquid securities or foreign securities, and those wouldn't necessarily have market values associated with them or current market values. So the SEC ultimately rejected the use of IIV coupled with IIV, intraday indicative value, coupled with prospectus disclosure about the investment strategy as a way to accommodate a non-transparent, actively managed ETF. The blind trust proponents looked at the SEC's comments on the proposal and have since refiled. And I think the refiling is an attempt to address all of the shortcomings, at least that the SEC saw, with the proposal. The other model is known as a proxy data model. And the proponents of the proxy data model essentially assert that if we can give authorized participants and market makers sufficient information to allow them to effectively hedge and arbitrage the ETF, then there's no need for transparency. And there are several different proposals out there on proxy data models, and they tend to vary by the type of metrics or information that the fund gives to the marketplace. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Laura Flores, who will talk about smart beta ETFs.
So as you can tell from Chris's presentation, ETFs are multifaceted, and there are a number of rules that fit into the background. But I think probably what interests most people is just the dynamic nature of ETFs and the trend with which they're growing. It's amazing how much ETFs have grown in the last decade, even though they've been around for a very long time, at least their predecessors. So smart beta ETFs, the important thing to understand about smart beta ETFs is that they are still a passively managed ETF. However, they are a passively managed or an index ETF with an active management bent or a twist. They came about because the market is basically saturated with traditional market cap weighted index ETFs. And so shops that haven't yet ventured into the ETF market are trying to figure out what they can enter with that's going to be appealing, provide a new option for investment for retail investors as well as institutional. And that is what smart beta ETFs are. They are designed to deliver performance that's slightly better, enhanced returns basically from an index or traditional index fund. And they also have the goal of trying to minimize the risk, or at least better capture certain areas of risk in the indexes that they are trying to track. The other important distinction is that these indexes, and this is what differentiates them from the traditional index funds, is that they basically have certain factors or screens that are overlaid or applied to the indexes in order to generate the enhanced performance and the minimization of the risks. So why are they getting so much attention? In addition to the fact that they're the new kid on the block, they also generally are providing again, the enhanced performance at a lesser cost than their actively managed ETF counterparts. That's something that's turning out to be very appealing. There's also a huge push right now, as you might have noticed, of smart beta ETFs into the marketplace. And I think just to name a few of the most recent entrants, there's Oppenheimer, The Hartford, and even Fidelity has now definitively gotten into the market with their smart beta ETFs. So I think we will continue to see more, although there is some suggestion now that the supply might actually be outpacing the demand. So we'll keep a close eye on that to see how that goes. And then very quickly, moving on to the regulatory implications of these smart beta ETFs. As Chris noted, there is a difference in the exemptive relief that's necessary to manage and operate a passively managed index fund versus an actively managed index fund. And this is something that the SEC is actually carefully watching these days. And with every new ETF we launch that looks a little more like an active management fund, an actively managed ETF, they start to question, are you operating this fund pursuant to the correct relief? If you don't have actively managed relief, they may question whether or not you're relying on the correct relief. So they are closely watching as these ETFs start to resemble more and more an actively managed ETF. The other regulatory implication is, and this is more from investment opportunities in these smart beta ETFs, because there is such a supply and there are so many with specialized strategies, the concern is now liquidity. Is there enough activity in those shares that it's generating a decent amount of liquidity in the shares? And then these indexes, they need to be based on securities. So a number of these smart beta ETF strategies are highly specialized. Some of them focus on commodities or require certain derivatives in order to enhance the returns, in order to try to capture a particular market inefficiency. And so to the extent that these strategies start to involve more derivatives, indexes that have other things than just securities, that presents an issue. And so that's something to keep an eye on when you're constructing a smart beta ETF. And then lastly, what should be a relatively innocuous legal issue, which is known as the NAMES rule or Rule 35D1, seems to be an increasingly painful thorn in the side of a number of these smart beta ETFs. And those fund complexes that are introducing these smart beta ETFs want to try to capture, in the name of the fund, whatever aspect of the market they're trying to realize or trying to reflect. With that goes along the regulatory requirement to have an 80% investment restriction. So in other words, that ETF will have to invest 80% of its net assets in whatever type of security is indicated by its fund's names. And that's increasingly becoming constraining to these funds that are trying to specialize in particular areas. So for instance, if you wanted to invest in some sort of environmental ETF that focused on water, that means that you'd have to invest in companies that generate their revenue largely from water-related activities. So that becomes a little bit of a challenge and is something to keep in mind. The next challenge is derivatives, and I'm going to turn it over to Jack. It's a very important topic, and start with that.
Thanks, Laura. So I want to spend 3 minutes talking about an 898-page SEC proposed rule release. So if you think back to the good old days, I'll call them before Dodd-Frank, the world of registered funds and private funds were a lot more separate than they are today. And now in the post-recession, post-Dodd-Frank era, a lot of traditional private fund and private asset managers have dabbled their toe into the registered fund, registered product space, and sub-advised or launched their own 40 Act strategies. Our partners, Tim Levin and Sean Graber, talked about that a little bit earlier on a panel. A recent tally had the so-called liquid alts industry at about $156 billion. And now there's a lot more of a combination. You know, a lot of shops are that were traditionally private are now registered and vice versa. I think the derivatives rule is interesting because that could result in that the pendulum sort of swinging the other way. And that's because, as proposed, the rule is, you know, could have a very substantial impact on the ability of registered funds to generate returns through the use of investment leverage. The rule was proposed in December. A recent speech on May 20th from SEC Chair Mary Jo White said that it's the SEC's responsibility to promptly finalize the rule, that this and other rules that were proposed last year, and that she expects the SEC to move forward this year with the derivatives proposal. So it seems as though there is a push to really accelerate the rulemaking process. There were over 160 comment letters received, a lot of criticism from the industry, the Investment Advisors Association, SIFMA, several dozen fund complexes all came out in criticism of the proposal. At a very high level, the proposal seeks to do three things for registered funds. Number one, it would impose limitations on the fund's investment portfolio's ability to use derivatives. They would be subject to a test of 150% of the fund's net assets. However, there is proposed to be some flexibility there that would allow for a 300% net asset test if the extra use of derivatives would result, based on a value at risk model, it would result in the fund actually having a lower risk portfolio. Number two, there's an asset segregation requirement. That's basically that the fund has to set aside assets, earmark them on their books to cover their position that they have in derivatives. That is old news. That's, you know, been the practice for a long time based on SEC guidance that's come out since 1979. However, what's new news about that is that the types of assets that funds would be required to use to cover those derivatives positions would be much narrower. So right now, it's a largely used market practice to cover with any liquid security, any derivatives position that a fund may have outstanding. As proposed, you're going to be very limited, registered funds would be very limited into what they could cover those positions with. And then third, boards, fund boards would be required to have a sort of oversight and a compliance function that would, in addition with other rule proposals that are out there, impose more and more responsibility on the shoulders of fund directors, which the boards that we are counseled to are very interested in and kind of nervous about. So what does that mean for the private fund industry? You know, number one, a lot of hedge fund shops are using leveraged and inverse ETFs that generate their returns based largely on a derivative-based portfolio. That product has become very specialized but widely used, and some of those products may, if they're not grandfathered in by the SEC, may go away. So that will be potentially one trading tool off the shelf for private funds. As a result, private funds that use those currently could go into other types of products that are not subject to the 40 Act and ironically could be higher risk than a 40 Act liquid product. But then also I think it's interesting that it could result in there being a little bit, you know, less competition in a way for between the registered and private fund circles. So that's why I sort of said I think this rule could be interesting in that it inadvertently could create more of a dichotomy that historically has always been there between private and registered products. So it remains to be seen. We're keeping a close eye on it, that's for sure, what happens at the end of the year here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.